Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning, welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. There is great news on the horizon this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Matt Hancock, Secretary of State for Health, has announced that human vaccine trials in the fight against COVID-19 will begin today in this great country of ours. Scientists in Oxford and London will speed through safety testing of a vaccine against the deadly virus in a bid to be the first country to develop a successful inoculation. In the Independent Republic, we wish them all well. What better way to show the world what an innovative, forward-thinking country we are? Are filled with expertise, a magnet for epidemiologists from around the world, and absolutely ready and able to find a way out of this health nightmare for the people of this country and the people of the rest of the world. Of course, The Guardian doesn't even think it's front page news. They prefer a story about government failures in buying face masks and nursing shortages. What is wrong with these lefty doom mongers? We are leading the world in finding a vaccine. Tell your readers about it, you collection of planks. 0344 499 1000. Coming up later today, we'll be visiting Westminster, where the first virtual Prime Minister's question gets underway. Dominic Raab and Keir Starmer are in position, and a handful of MPs are actually in the chamber. Now, as I said to Julia Hartley Brewer, I'm not entirely certain how it is that you justify driving or taking the train down from northern England, from Bradford, for example. The Bradford West MP is going to be in there. From other parts of the UK, like Bracknell. You know, I haven't seen my own children for 4 weeks, and I'm not looking for sympathy here, but what I'm saying is that if it's good enough for me to make that sacrifice, why do these bozos have to turn up in Parliament to be in the House of Commons for Prime Minister's questions when they could quite easily do it virtually from home? And of course, no doubt, the astonishing story of how senior civil servant Sir Simon McDonald, apparently due to what he's called a misunderstanding, and I'm calling a deliberate piece of disinformation, managed to accuse the government of making a political decision not to participate in the EU procurement agreement scheme. Where do they find these people? Oh yeah, hiding under the Ramona rocks somewhere near Dover. 0344 499 1000. As ever, we want to hear from you out there because you're on the front line of the lockdown. We want your stories, we want your knowledge, and we want to hear your problems as well. They're all very, very important to us, so please do get in touch. 0344 499 1000. Coming up on homeschooling today, we are going to be learning some first aid techniques just in case of accidents in the home. So get the kids around the radio for 12:30. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on what is a great day, Wednesday, April the 22nd, because I can tell you on the front page of the Times this morning, British human vaccine trials to start tomorrow. This was Matt Hancock's announcement on the briefing yesterday, which was very, very well received indeed, because, of course, we in Britain have got a great advantage in terms of epidemiology, in terms of virology. Of course, there are great professors around the world, but many of them are drawn to work in this country because this is where excellence is key, and this is where we find answers to questions that everybody else asks. And I think this is a fantastic opportunity for this country to actually go ahead and be the first ever country in the world to find a vaccine for this ghastly coronavirus, because as many people as are being killed, there are still many people who are being saved from death. There are still many people who are recovering from it. There are antibodies going around. There are blood plasma situations going on as well. I think this country has an opportunity to show what it is best at. Let's get rid of the doom and gloom. Let's stop the negativity. Let's actually all get together, invite as many experts in from around the world as possible. But let Britain be first to find a cure for this horrible disease. Let's talk to Professor George Lomonosov, virologist at the John Innes Centre. George, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, I'm not trying to get too carried away with this vaccine hope, because I know it may take a while, but it's quite remarkable the speed at which we're doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's fantastic. And actually, it's a good representation of the scientific advances made in the last, well, I'd say 15 years.
Yeah.
That you can actually get these things which we call candidate vaccines. You can actually make them really quickly.
Okay.
And of course, you do base that design on previous knowledge of coronaviruses. I mean, we haven't experienced this particular one in the past, but we've had SARS and MERS as human viruses, but also there are various veterinary ones which affect pigs. So, there's a bit of a framework there. But using these modern techniques of synthetic biology, you can really get to the starting gate far more quickly than you could even, say, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Tell us what will have to happen before we can actually get something that we can use. What will be happening this week, I suppose, is what I'm asking you.
Yeah. Well, I suspect, now, I don't have any inside information on the exact details of the trials, but I suspect there'll be phase one clinical trials, and those are basically safety tests. Obviously, you can't, you make something new, it's not been injected into a person before, you can't immediately just make millions of doses and hope that there's going to be no unexpected side effects.
Right.
So you'll do a small-scale trial just to really check that the way you've produced the material and the material itself is quite safe, and you don't get any major kind of issues. Then, if it's proven to be safe, which we absolutely all hope it does, and I have every reason to expect it will, you then go on to the next phase, which is normally this thing called phase two, where you look at the ability of the material, in this particular case, to raise antibodies. You know, does it do what it's supposed to do? Will you get an antibody response? And that takes a bit longer because it does take quite a few days for you to, after you've been given an injection or indeed caught the disease, to raise the antibodies.
Right.
And then you have to get an assessment of whether the those antibodies are likely to protect you. And that can be done with various lab tests. And the final phase, phase three, and I'm not quite sure how they intend to do this, there are various ways, is you then check whether it really does protect people. The word would be challenge them, either deliberately or expose them just in the community to the actual virus.
Yeah.
And follow them. And those are the bits which it's quite difficult to reduce the time, because our immune system responds with a certain progression. And, and all the synthetic biology won't speed that up at the moment. The other thing you then have to do, and you can do this in parallel, it's not necessarily one after the other, is, and I think I heard the item from Cal Sikora, saying it's scaling up production. Because it was very impressive, I heard on the news that, there'll be a million doses available. And absolutely, I'm not knocking that as being impressive. But, of course, you probably need 30, 40, 50 million doses for this country alone.
Well, it's a bit like the argument about PPE, isn't it? But there's never going to be enough of it. So as soon as you produce it, it will disappear.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, we don't know. We hope, and again, this is something we'll find out, is will a single inoculation be enough? You may have to repeat it at intervals.
Mm.
I'm not saying we will, but that can happen. You need boosters. And you can think of your tetanus booster.
Yes.
It doesn't last forever. And so you do need sometimes to repeat. Tetanus, I stress, is a bacterial infection, not a virus. But
no, of course. How will they select the sort of the volunteers, as it were? Because presumably in something like this, the vaccine, one, obviously needs to be safe for everybody, but also, two, you have to ensure that you're not doing any harm by testing it on people.
Yeah, and the first case, and I've read something about this, and it's a fairly standard thing, you take healthy people with no underlying health problems, youngish. I mean, but you don't want to just be all incredibly young, fit people, because you need to be able to vaccinate be effective in a range of ages, but you'll be careful.
Mm.
And it'll be quite a small number. And they'll be selected, you know, probably from different parts of the country to try and get a mix. And then check the other vital thing is you make sure you don't get anyone who is either pregnant or likely to be pregnant.
Right.
And so you tend to get more men than women participating for that, just for that reason.
Yes, I see. And as far as the trials and the sort of the progress of those trials, do they trial sort of different things exponentially, if you like? So, you know, whatever they get to in maybe August will be different to what they're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, what tends to happen is with trials, you tend to have to fix it fairly early. So you go to the phase one, you have a certain material, the safety one. You can't then use a different material for the next one because you won't have done the safety test.
Right.
So you have to sort of decide fairly early on, we'll go with this. It doesn't mean you can't layer and start another phase one trial with a variant, you know, at the same time, have them sort of interleaved and progressing at different speeds. And actually, that's probably what's going to happen throughout the world.
Mm.
There are other trials going on in other countries, and they'll probably be with different formulations. And it'll be very interesting to see, more than interesting, I mean, really critical to see which ones are the most effective, and let's hope at least one of them is.
And when you find the vaccine to be correct, as it were, are there groups of people who it might not work for, or does that depend on each individual vaccine?
Well, that's very true, and that is an issue. And the people you can't even give it to, for instance, or it won't be effective, like people who are immunocompromised.
Right.
Or undergoing, you know, that will often be people undergoing chemotherapy.
And quite often those are the most vulnerable people, aren't they?
Absolutely. And this is where actually the respectable version of herd immunity comes in.
Right.
That if you get, well, you hear various figures depending on the vaccine, 50, 60, ideally 80 if it's possible, percent of the population. The remaining percentage are usually protected from disease because the virus can't be transmitted anymore.
Right.
It dies out immediately because most of the people are immune. And so you do get this concept that you don't have to get 100% of people vaccinated to effectively get 100% infection. Immunity from infection.
Yes. And as we go through the summer, the herd immunity question, I presume, will come up again because more and more people will have got it. One of the figures I'm seeing in the Times this morning is that quite a low number of people have actually got the virus. So, you know, the original thought that basically everyone will get it eventually doesn't seem to be happening yet.
Yeah, and of course we deliberately tried to stop that because with all the social distancing. It's a big issue. Oh, and the other thing I should have mentioned with the vaccine, you mustn't have ever have any evidence you've actually already had coronavirus.
Yeah.
Because then you might have immunity anyway and you won't know it's the vaccine.
But even with that, we're not entirely certain, are we? We're not
absolutely not.
Sure.
There's the PCR-based tests we have at the moment. I mean, they tell you, are you infected now?
Yeah.
Are you producing virus now? There's all this hope of antibody tests,
right,
which will tell you, have you got antibodies, which is a good indication you've been exposed. But there's been issues. I mean, exactly what you're testing for in these cases. And those, there's a great hope they'd be available very, very quickly. And it's obviously taken a bit longer because the immune system makes all sorts of types of responses and antibodies. And you want to get, you know, make sure you can distinguish the ones which are in response to coronavirus from all the other ones.
Yes. Well, this is where the testing argument sort of falls apart, doesn't it? Because they've had this problem in South Korea, and we appear to have had the same problem now with some of the early NHS worker testing, that the tests might not have been particularly accurate. Because in South Korea, they were saying that they thought some people were getting reinfected, when in fact what it meant was that they had been infected and they were still infected, but the test that originally said they were not infected was wrong.
Yes, I mean, and that's these things you have to do, and it's such a critical part of testing, is have, you know, what are called the controls, that you make sure that you don't. And the one that people really fear is a false negative.
Yes.
Which is that you go out and you think you're not infected and then reinfect people. A false positive is not great, but this would mean you'd self-isolate unnecessarily.
Well, I mean, it's not great if you can't work for 2 weeks and
no,
you can't,
not great,
make, it,
it's not,
can't make any money.
Yeah, indeed, it's not great, but it's not as bad as going and reinfecting
no.
people.
No, but why would you say the tests are so inconclusive or so unreliable?
Well, there's an issue that you have to remember what the material is. So it's actually a throat swab. It's not a nice, clear lab sample. So a lot of the controls are very purified reagents to calibrate your machine.
Right.
Whereas what you're actually testing on is something that's basically mucus.
Yes.
And you're having to extract any viral genetic material from that.
Mm.
And, of course, there can be things inhibiting it. So it's not quite identical between, you know, that you can say the test is valid on the control,
yeah,
and it looks good, but actually for some reason it's failed because the sample isn't quite the same. Now, there are lots of ways and people are working on trying to, you know, get the controls better,
yeah,
so they're more, you know, reliable, and they're more, you know, sort of they mimic the test situation better. And I think that's one of the issues.
Yeah, I mean, one of the inconsistencies I find about Britain at the moment is that we're still allowing loads of people to fly into the country, come out of the aeroplane, walk through the airport terminal, walk out through customs and into the big wide world without any sort of mention of a test of any kind, without any suggestion of going into quarantine for 7 days or maybe 14 days. Somebody that I know, an Australian friend of mine, flew back to Australia last week. He was taken from the airport in a coach, basically, effectively, with three other people who were Australian nationals, taken to a hotel and put into a room on his own, quarantined for 14 days.
Right, yeah.
Shouldn't we be doing that?
Oh, yeah, I mean, in certain countries, I mean, my son lives in New Zealand, and, I mean, they have an incredibly strict lockdown. Yeah, I've been surprised. I haven't, you know, don't know all the details of what happens, but I've certainly heard stories of, you know, the lack of controls at borders just for testing. I mean, it's not it could be British people coming.
Yeah, I mean, this is not an argument about foreign nationals or anything.
Like
but we're getting plane loads of Romanians coming into fruit pick, right? Now, as far as I know, according to one of the farming association people I spoke to, they've all been tested in Romania before they get here. But, you know, they're going straight to a farm to work. They're in this country. I don't know whether they've been tested or not.
Well, I wouldn't know the answer to that. I mean, I suppose you'd have to rely on...
But doesn't it seem a bit cavalier compared to what other countries are doing?
It does. I mean, personally, yes. I mean, this is a personal opinion. I do find it slightly odd.
Yeah.
And you can fly around and enter...
Well, this is it. I mean, my reasoning for asking you, Professor, is because, you know, we can take as many measures as we want. We can take as many, you know, false tests as we want. But in the end, if we're not stopping people from coming here who might be infected, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean... indeed, I mean, one can take precautions, even if you allow that, you know, to test on arrival or, you know, automatically
quarantine. Well, just put them in quarantine for 2 weeks. You know, that would solve it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it would do. I mean, that would certainly reduce the risk.
Yeah.
Yes, and require that. That is a measure which could be put in. And as you rightly say, other countries have done that.
Yes. And other countries, by the same token, appear to have a slightly better percentage of infection rates as well by shutting down. And I'm not, you know, I'm not having to go at anybody. I'm just saying that there are some inconsistencies, like MPs, for example, travelling down to London to appear at the House of Commons today when they could have quite easily done it from home.
Yeah, it'd be quite interesting, that. I mean, I don't know in an individual case why they decided that.
Yeah, I know.
And it's one of these things, though. It's an ill wind. I mean, in some ways, I think some of the things which might have to be done because of the social distancing might, you know, you can imagine them actually improving certain things, like not requiring unnecessary travel, for instance.
Well, I mean, that's what the rest of us are having to do, because I'm going to get people all fed up with me complaining all the time. But I haven't seen my own children for 4 weeks because I've chosen not to travel to Sussex, which is about 50 miles away, because I think that would be irresponsible. And yet now I'm seeing our elected MPs doing exactly what I've not been doing.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's always been the idea that you could travel to your place of work if it was deemed essential. And I guess that's the view.
Yeah, but it's not essential, is it?
Yeah, if they can
that's
do
the
it
point.
Online.
Yeah. I mean, they can do it. I mean, you know, there's 650 MPs, right? The large bulk of them are not going there. Therefore, it's not essential.
Yeah. I think there was actually hearing, and I don't really know the truth or otherwise of this, is that they wanted to get a certain number in the chamber. But I suppose it could have gone for more local people.
Well, I mean, you know, Keir Starmer's up in Islington. That's fine. But the guy who's coming down from Bradford, Naz Shah coming down from Bradford West, right? Chris Elmore coming from Ogmore, Bolsover's MP Mark Fletcher coming in. You know, they're not close enough, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not forbidden to travel to work. So, I mean, I honestly don't know in their particular cases why.
No, listen, and I'm not putting you on the spot. I apologise. I'm just sort of venting, really, for want of a better word.
Because, okay, I think
because
we all do now.
We all do a bit of that. Luckily, I've got 3 hours of venting that I can do every single
day. Oh, you
do
on air.
Exactly right. Professor George Lomonosov, thank you very much indeed, virologist at the John Innes Centre. It's great news, by the way, that we do have the wherewithal to now test the vaccine on human beings, which is a massive step forward, which is something, normally speaking, that wouldn't be happening probably for years and years. but we're making it happen in this country because we are in a position to show the rest of the world the way forward. And I think it's a magnificent day and I would like to celebrate it, and I'm sure you would as well. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We've got lots to do. We're going to be doing Prime Minister's questions later on. We're going to talk to various people, including Professor Inderjeet Palmer. It turns out that Missouri, the state of Missouri, the great state of Missouri, you might say, is now suing China. This could be the start of something big. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We'll take some of your calls before the news. 0344 499 1000 is the number to call us on. Lots of you want to get through. Many of you will be getting through today. Let's talk now, though, to Professor Inderjeet Palmer, Professor of International Politics at the University of London, because a couple of interesting developments overnight. Boris Johnson, it turns out, has had a conversation with Donald Trump about his recovery from the coronavirus, but also, I would imagine, about the role that China has played in the whole thing and what should happen next. We've also heard that the state of Missouri is suing China for not doing enough to stop the coronavirus spread. And I would imagine, Dr. Inderjeet, that this might just be the beginning of something. Very good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's a continuation of a long story of kind of a conflict, or at least a degree of turbulence in the U.S. relationship with China, which didn't start with Donald Trump, but has certainly come to a bit of a kind of a climax, really. But I think we need to take it in the round. But yes, clearly there's a lot of heat in this particular issue at the moment.
Well, there really is, because we've got stories coming out of China that the wet markets are still open. There's also stories that, you know, there could have been a link to a lab as well as to somebody who was infected and then possibly passed it on to somebody who then went to a wet market. You know, there's a bit of still confusion around what happened exactly and exactly where the coronavirus kind of incubated, if you like. But also lots of questions being asked about how early China knew towards the end of last year that they had this thing.
Yeah, clearly. And I think most states, and authoritarian states in particular, they seek to always protect themselves from any kind of legitimate public criticism and so on. And I think the Chinese state has done exactly that. But the key issue, I think, with the Chinese state is to see that there is a kind of central national state, and then there are provinces. And I think the initial cover-up, if you like, or attempt to prevent the news getting out was at the provincial level. Once the national state, President Xi, got involved, things moved a lot more quickly.
Mm.
But there is a lot of confusion at the moment, and nobody really knows exactly what happened in regard to the origins of this particular virus. And I think that's going to be the subject of many, many speculations for a long time to come.
Well, certainly it's going to be more. Surely it should be more than that, shouldn't it? I mean, the Foreign Minister of Australia has already asked for some kind of official inquiry to be done by some kind of international body. Certainly the state of Missouri won't be the only state of America that decides it wants to sue the Chinese government. So this isn't going away anytime soon.
No, I think there are two levels. One is actually what did happen and what can be done in future by organisations like the World Health Organization, but also prior to 2017, after President Trump came in, he actually did dismantle certain aspects of the global pandemic infrastructure, which the U.S. had set up pretty much from the time of George W. Bush. So he had begun to dismantle the intelligence, which was coming directly, for example, from China, from Wuhan, actually, which was coming to the United States and elsewhere, so that they could have done something about it early on.
So what do you mean by dismantled it? What did he dismantle exactly?
Well, for example, the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. are linked with the Centers of Disease Control in at least 55 other countries, including China. So you have teams of experts and scientists who are training local people in 55 countries to, if you like, detect the outbreak of any kind of an epidemic, take very early remedial action, centralize information, send it around to the World Health Organization and elsewhere, and thereby effectively try to contain it, which is what effectively happened with Ebola and other things previously. What President Trump has done is he's gradually dismantled the people on the ground and the people in those roles So, for example, the one person who was in Wuhan from the U.S. Was told that their job's going to be gone by September 2019. They quit in July.
So there was one guy in China, and that's what we were relying on?
Well, no, it's not one guy. It's a team of American experts and so on who collaborate with local health providers, etc. So what you've got is early warning systems.
Yeah, but Inderjit, I think it's a bit disingenuous to start blaming President Trump for the Wuhan virus outbreak when China deliberately withheld information from the World Health Organization and lied about it.
Well, I think what we have to look at is the whole chain of events to try to uncover what happened. Now, you talk about the state of Missouri, for example, wanting to sue China. And that may well be a very good political ploy because that'll play well with some electors. But in practice, who's going to go and collect any kind of compensation from China in real life? When big powers violate norms or laws, you know that there is no world police which enforces laws in other countries, especially countries as powerful as China or the United States or any other in that regard. So this is a political or PR...
But there are international organisations, aren't there, like the G12 or the G8 or something like that, which surely should have and could have some authority over China because somebody needs to do it.
Well, you can ask questions. You can create a large amount of, create an inquiry. You could even organise an inquiry where China doesn't necessarily collaborate completely because they're unlikely to. But in the end, if you like, great powers are not very willing to give up A, information, and B, pay any compensation because they have the power to resist it. So what I'm talking about is that effectively, in realistic terms, great powers don't bend to,
Well, there's an awful lot of trade between China and the rest of the world, for example, and that could be affected by China's conduct, surely.
Yes, well...
I mean, we don't have to buy everything from China, do we?
That's true, but if you look at the strategic significance of the Chinese economy and the interdependencies of the Chinese economies with the West, with every other country in the world practically, China is a great economic power. So
yes, and they position themselves in that.
Supply chains are already implicated and broken or loosened by this. So the amount of economic leverage you can exert over China is limited by the fact that you are reliant on China for your own production and economy as
no,
well.
No, of course. And I think we have allowed that to happen, and wrongly, in my view, to a very, very large extent. But I think people are beginning to realise that it's perhaps not the wisest position to be in when you can't get stuff that you need because they could also withhold it if they want.
Absolutely. That's what economic interdependence does allow.
Right.
It allows for a large amount of economic leverage where you feel you need to exert it and so on. It does also make you vulnerable because other powers can, in the longer run, break their supply lines, change them, and so on.
Yes.
But the problem is that the relationship between China and the U.S. isn't a kind of direct one, or only direct. If you were to switch your supply chains, which under President Trump there has been a movement to do that, to other countries in Southeast Asia, for example, the problem is that those economies themselves are reliant on the Chinese economy too.
Yes. So, well, they've been very smart. I mean, they have deliberately had a policy of expansionism economically and physically and geographically over the past 20 years, and it's worked brilliantly for them. But this is now why we find ourselves where we are.
Well, the thing is, the rise of China, if you like, the integration of China into the world economy was in actual practice an American and a Chinese elite project. So if you look from the period of just before the death of Mao, in the 1970s, and straight after that, there were Chinese elites which wanted to open up China and for China to enter the world, as not a revolutionary power, but as a kind of power which is going to accommodate and to integrate. And there were equal number of forces from the United States which assisted that in collaboration with the Chinese leadership in the 80s and into the 90s, and by 2001, integrated China into the World Trade Organization, for example. So what the effective view of each of those two sides in that bargain was that they wanted China to be a kind of global, or at least a regional player, a big economy, a big market, and a big producer. And that has actually happened. But as we know, as economies become more powerful, their states become more ambitious, and their states begin to develop goals which may be at odds with the people who helped them to get to that position in the first place, and they don't want to necessarily play the kind of junior or supportive or subordinated role. And I think that's effectively what's happened. And alongside that, if you like, with the Iraq war, with the 2008 financial crisis, I think China's become more confident. China's become more ambitious, more assertive.
Mm-hmm.
The Belt and Road Initiative is a worldwide program. And I think the United States and other countries have become more and more worried because the U.S. has lost position.
Well, strangely, the U.S. has become less efficient and its infrastructure more kind of tattered as China has improved all of those things in its own country. But listen, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Inderjit Palmer there from the University of London, Professor of International Politics. I think China has to be held to account in some way, shape or form. I'm not buying this kind of mantra that you can't touch China, they're too big. Let's go to the phone to talk to Craig, who's in Oxford. Hi, Craig.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Very well, sir. What can I do for you?
Yeah, we've got a good news day for the first time in a while.
Well, I wouldn't say for the first time in a while. It's always a good news day here when we talk about the good things that are going on rather than just the bad things that are going on.
Well, that is true, but we've got some positive steps taken towards being able to resume some form of a normal life eventually.
Yes, that would be nice.
So
I was delighted to find this morning on my way in a little Italian deli, which was able to serve me with a breakfast bap and a proper coffee, not from a machine, for the first time since about 4 weeks ago. So very happy
it's
about
it. It's the little things.
It is. The act of ordering some food that I hadn't made was fantastic, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's good news. We've got to see how this trial goes.
Yes.
Obviously, I think the Oxford University are behind, but it's actually being produced through an independent pharmaceutical company based in Oxford, who are the pioneers behind the Chimera leukemia treatment.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Because you're up in that neck of the woods, aren't you?
We are, yeah. So they've got the the intellectual property for the manufacturing process.
Okay.
So they're the ones that can produce it. I think the only thing that we've got to bear in mind is how fast they can produce the vaccine, which I think is going to be the main issue.
And will they be supplying it to Public Health England for the trials, or will they be actually doing the trials?
I believe the trials will be done through the university. So the company making it will just be making the drug. They'll provide it to the university or to Public Health England for the trials, and then it will go from there. But my understanding would question their ability to be able to make enough vaccine in a quick enough amount of time.
Yeah. Well, they can only do what they can do. And I mean, any vaccine is better than no vaccine. So I would say it's the opposite of the testing argument, isn't it? Where a bad test is worse than no test. But actually, whatever they can produce, we'll take it. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the long and short of it, I don't believe they'll know until they actually start making it to see how many doses are produced from the process that runs through.
Right. Also, I suppose it depends on what they need to get to make the vaccine, as it were, what the supply of that is.
Yes, it's all done in bioreactors, and it's down to the size of the bioreactor is to how many doses they get out of it. And I think, optimistically, at the moment, you might be looking at somewhere in the 20,000 to 30,000 doses a month at the moment.
All right.
I mean, hopefully that turns out to be on the low side. Mm. But it's just, at the moment, we might find ourselves in a situation where the company with the intellectual property to make the vaccine can't produce it on a large enough scale on their own, and then you end up in a situation where companies to share intellectual property in order to be able to get things out.
Well, surely you could franchise it out, couldn't you?
I'd imagine so. I'm sure they're, I think public health has to come first.
If we are able to find the cure or the vaccine to stop people from getting it, surely we would share that with the world, wouldn't we?
You believe so. I mean, the problem comes is if the process that you use to make it is used in other things, and the secret would be out on other things.
Yes.
So it wouldn't just be if you're showing them sharing a process, it's beneficial for this treatment, but for example, the leukemia treatment, which is in the hundreds of thousands of pounds a dose cost, all of a sudden you've kind of let the wolf out of the bag on how yeah. how that's done. Or
well, I'm not really interested in people protecting themselves financially when the world needs saving from a deadly virus. But listen, Craig, I take your point. I understand that that's the way the business works. But listen, everything has to work differently from this point on. If you've got the cure for something or the prevention for something, a prophylactic, you need to share that with the rest of the world. And if we invent it here in the UK, surely... we would be the kings of the world and we would be able to give it to other countries. And well, you should give it to other countries. Why wouldn't you?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Prime Minister's question is still ongoing. Dominic Raab in for Boris Johnson, of course, and then Keir Starmer, who is the new leader of the Labour Party, also doing the job that Jeremy Corbyn used to do. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, has come in to Parliament as well because he's going to ask a health question to Matt Hancock, who is going to be taking health questions later on this afternoon. It looks as though something like Tuesdays and Wednesdays are going to be now the 3 days that Parliament sits. They're going to be sitting pretty much in absentia. And as I've said earlier, I don't know where a lot of these MPs who are in there have come from, but certainly they represent some constituencies which are quite far outside of London. And if they have travelled, I would not like to think that that was what they're going to do on a regular basis. I don't think that's a very good idea at all. But it's now time for some homeschooling, because this is 12:30, just after, every single day. Yesterday we had a fascinating virtual tour of the Tower of London with Pepe, who I think we're going to go back to do some more virtual tours of parts of London, which were very interesting. We've also done maths with Carol Vorderman. We've done great stuff about space with Greg Smyrumsby. We've had chefs on. We've had all sorts of experts in classical languages. Today, I'm very pleased to say, it's time to welcome back Emma Hammett, CEO of First Aid for Life, the woman who taught me how to give artificial respiration to a dog, which was rather exciting. Very, very good afternoon to you, Emma. Welcome back.
Hi, lovely to be back.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, it sounds like I'm in very good company on your homeschooling.
Well, do you know, it's turned out to be a really, really interesting segment. You know, I just thought about it because my own kids are home from school, and when you're not a trained teacher, which most parents are not, you know, it's quite nice to have a sort of 10-minute break from whatever it is that you're doing, that your kids can sit around, listen to the radio, and also maybe learn something.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, first aid is part of the curriculum now, so...
Yes.
Let's go for it.
Well, let's go for it, because you all know particularly what are the most important things to teach children, because I suppose, as I said before the news, one of the most important things is you want to try and avoid having as many accidents as possible when you are at home, because you don't want to be going to hospital at the moment for anything other than coronavirus, really. So tell us what you would teach the kids, first of all.
OK, well, a few things. I mean, first of all, you've got a lot of people at home. You've got a lot of people doing DIY,
Yep. You've
got a lot of people doing gardening, you've got kids pushing boundaries, and the dangers of people going sort of stir-crazy too. So accidents happen in the home all the time anyway, and we usually rely on our emergency services to be there for us.
Yes.
Now, one point to say is they are still there for us. They are still operating for non-coronavirus issues. So if you do have a serious accident or a serious illness, it's really important you do get help quickly.
Yes.
And there will be places for them which are safer and protected from the main coronavirus areas. So a lot of the health professionals are saying that, you know, people, admissions are dropping and they're worried that there's going to be collateral damage because of it.
Right.
But onto the homeschooling, when I spoke to you last, you had an injury with your thumb.
That's right.
And it had bled a lot.
Very well remembered.
And we were talking about it.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how to stop a bleeding wound.
Yes.
So I thought that would be quite a good first one of these to go through.
Okay.
Okay. So if you had, say you were helping your parents do some DIY at home, something went wrong... or you were helping with the cooking, and you ended up cutting yourself, and it was a serious wound that was bleeding a lot.
Yes.
What would you do?
Well, I would now, having been told by you very bravely and wisely, I would now hold it up, sort of upright, as it were, so that it's not dripping blood into the sink, which is what I was doing the previous time, and I would squeeze it very hard to stop the blood flow.
Yes, absolutely. Now, previously, were you washing it?
Well, yes. I mean, I was running it under a tap because I somehow thought that that might help.
So if you're running under the tap, if you think about your blood and that your blood is better in your body than out of your body because your body needs it, if you are applying direct pressure, you are keeping the blood in your body and you will stop it coming out.
Right.
Whereas if you're running it under the tap, you are losing all that precious blood straight down into the sink.
Yeah. So, and it was running out at quite a rate as well.
Well, it does, and particularly if you're warm, because if you're warm, then your blood vessels will dilate and get larger,
right,
which means that the amount of blood that you will lose, you'll lose it at a greater rate.
Right. I was amazed, actually, how much blood I lost that I didn't pass out.
Yeah, well, actually, it always looks a bit worse than it is,
to be
totally honest.
Mm.
So, I mean, bearing in mind that you hadn't actually cut your thumb off.
Well, it felt like it. I'll tell you what. But, I mean, I was told as well by a doctor, because it was a nail injury, effectively, that the blood is very, very close to the skin there, which is why it was bleeding quite as profusely as it was. Because if I've ever cut my finger, as you occasionally nick it on a knife or something like that, it tends to stop quite quickly anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and when we say a nail injury, it was a nail as in the nail on your hand rather than a nail that you'd put your hand on.
Yes, I hadn't put my hand on a nail. Well, that's one of the worst things you can do, isn't it?
Well, it's not nice.
No.
None of it's nice, to be honest. So when you are, you have cut yourself and it is bleeding, what you want to do is get some non-fluffy material.
Yes.
So a nice clean tea towel, if you've got it.
Yes.
Or in your first aid kit, you might have a triangular bandage.
Yes.
Grab one of those and use it to apply direct pressure. If you have access to gloves, then put them on. I mean, at the moment, you're likely to be dealing with your own family environment anyway, in your own household. So this is more relevant when you're out and about and it's non-coronavirus. However, always protect yourself with gloves if at all possible.
Yes, you're talking like latex gloves, yeah?
Yeah, just gloves.
Well, one of the things I've been telling people...
We've got gloves around at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a load... We had a load in the office here, so I took some home, and I went out shopping last Saturday to the supermarket, and I wore them for that. And then I was also told, very important, so once you've done one thing, to throw them away. You don't keep them on, you know, all day, because then you're just carrying the germs around.
Absolutely, and you're transferring the germs from one place to the other, and you feel safe.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you're spreading the germs around your house, around other places, wherever you go.
Sure. Now, you mentioned a first aid kit. If a family doesn't have one of those, are they easy to get a hold of?
Yes, they're easily available online. Make sure you're getting a good quality one. So look at the reviews and things, because sometimes there's just tick boxes that are happening that sort of suggest what the vital contents should be.
Right.
But actually, you want to have a quality one with quality stuff inside, and see if it's got if it fulfills HSE requirements. That's a good thing to look out for. So a good quality family kit with some triangular bandages and some sensible dressings, and every household should have one, and ideally you should have one in your car as well.
And what about plasters and stuff like that?
Soft one. In terms of plasters, I'm not a great lover of plasters.
Okay.
Plasters can make wounds go soggy. They can be really helpful. So the sort of injury you had, once you've stopped it bleeding, it can take up to about 10 minutes to stop the wound, the blood coming out.
Yes.
So once you've stopped it bleeding, if it's somewhere like by your nail where you're likely to catch it again, then it's really helpful to put a plaster on. But don't just leave it and forget about it. And obviously, if you're washing your hands and your plaster's got soggy, you need to take it off.
Yes.
The soggy wound will get infected.
Okay. And what about
Key thing for, you know, quite serious, so imagine you are doing some cooking and you've cut your hand, cut your finger quite nastily, it's bleeding a lot. So you would grab some dry, clean non-fluffy cloth, so a tea towel or something,
yeah.
And you would apply direct pressure over it, and you would hold it tight for up to 10 minutes until it stopped bleeding, and then you would dress it. So it might be that you need a sort of gauze bandage at that point.
Yes.
To dress it.
Okay.
Have a look at it after a little while, and if it looks like it's a gaping wound or it's not looking like it's going to heal normally, then you will need to contact your GP, and they can do a video assessment, or the nurse at the GP practice can do a video assessment and just see whether or not they think it's going to need some Steri-Strips. Obviously, if you've got some Steri-Strips in your kit, you can use those. Sometimes it might need gluing.
Okay.
So if you've bashed your head, heads and faces will bleed a huge amount, because I know you said your finger was pretty vascular.
Yeah.
Heads and faces will pour blood because they're very vascular. They've got lots of blood vessels around the surface.
And you can't really apply pressure to your head, can you?
For a long time.
You can't really apply pressure to your head, can you?
Well, you can.
You
would literally just fold up your tea towel and hold it onto your head.
Okay. I went through about three tea towels that night. It was a bit like that scene from Goodfellas, you know, when the guy got shot outside the pizza place. But let me ask you one final thing. What about burns? You mentioned cooking. A lot of kids will be cooking with their parents, maybe baking, that kind of thing. What happens with burns? What's the best way to treat a burn?
Burns, they've just updated the guidance, actually. So burns, you should hold the burn under cool running water for a full 20 minutes.
Okay.
Now, if you do that, you will actually increase the rate at which your body will heal that burn. You will reduce the skin damage. You will reduce the depth of the burn. And you can actually heal an awful lot of that burn yourself just by cool running water.
Okay. If it's a particularly... How would you know how bad it is? Is it how it looks in case you need to go to a hospital? Because obviously, you know, we've all seen people getting, you know, the difference between sort of first degree, secondary, third degree, you know, a really bad burn. You probably need to go and get it looked at, don't you?
Yeah, all burns in children should be assessed. And again, that can be done by video in the current climate. But if it is blistered and if it's bigger than your palm, so if it's for a baby, for example, if it's bigger than a 50p piece, then that would be, you know, considered to be quite a serious burn.
Okay.
I would get them seen. If it's more serious than that, you might need to phone an ambulance.
Mm.
Whilst you're waiting for the ambulance, you continue to run under cool running water. And if it's, you know, an adult and they're going to, they think it's not quite as bad, if you want to dress the burn, then once you've cooled it for a full 20 minutes, you can use some cling film, take off the outside of the cling film and just use some of the middle bits and just lay it over loosely.
Right.
And never pull any clothes that have stuck to a burn. So if clothes or anything has stuck to the burn or jewellery is stuck tightly, never force it off.
Okay, great stuff. Well, listen, Emma, very useful as ever to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Emma Hammett, CEO of First Aid for Life. As Emma said, if you haven't got one, you should get your hands on a first aid kit just to have at home and try not to have any accidents. But, I mean, that's why they're called accidents, because you're not trying to have them. They just happen. But good luck with all of that. We'll be back with some more homeschooling tomorrow.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.